Hey, you know, I confess to not feeling really fit as that proverbial fiddle here. Last couple of days, I'm feeling sort of run down, and I don't know that I'm actually sick, but just run down. Bit of a headache and all that, so I couldn't rub two brain cells together here as I was trying to prepare this lesson for this evening insofar as slides were going. And so finally, after I got started in it, you know, and I thought, I'm just not going to do it. So tonight we're not going to have any presentation on the screen itself, but I'm hoping that I'll be able to put something together just to hand out then for next week when we get together here so you can have these scriptures. Lacking that, though, this evening, still really a good idea to get your paper and pencil out. Tonight especially will be one of those nights where I'm going to give you a series of verses, one that will be foretelling an event, the other that is the fulfillment of that event. Trying to make it very, very simple, just one verse each, and we'll be combining then tonight, in a way, two different sets of material that we've been looking at. We had already looked at prophecy, had four classes, I think, on that topic, and we'll be looking at that again tonight. We've been talking about miracles. We've had three lessons on miracles, and tonight we're combining the two. It is a miracle if you can foretell the future. It is not a miracle if you can guess the future. I'm guessing that we will have colder days to come in this winter, and then it'll get warmer. What do you think? Okay, not much of a prophecy, is it? The odds are high because that's the way things normally work. And yet I am telling you this is what I think will happen in the future. What was our definition of a miracle? A miracle requires... mind like a steel trap. Because you wrote it down. See? And this is exactly why I asked everybody to get your paper and your pencil now, because you are absolutely photographic memory when you write it down. That's exactly it. And so you did. You picked up on various definitions that we use. It's not just an unusual event. It's not just an amazing event. It is an impossible event. And prophecy then really falls into that category. Way back when we were talking in the first lessons about prophets, the bar is set very, very high for God's prophets. They must never be wrong. They must very specifically set forth what it is that's going to take place, and then it has to be fulfilled in precisely without any fair, any error, you know, or failure whatsoever, in order for this to be, for them to be recognized, identified as a prophet of God. So there's our definition, and one who can foretell the future in meticulous detail and then have it come to pass is participating in a miracle. They are being given information that only God could know. Not guessing, not lucky, it's too specific. Okay, now, with regard to miracles, tell me, what is the purpose of a miracle?
Confirm the word.
To confirm the word. What scripture would you cite which says that?
Mark 16:17-20
comes our response. I'm the only one among us. You know what? Photographic memory. Mark 16. And it's there that I suggested you make the list of the other passages. So you've got Mark, you've got Acts chapter 14, verse 23, I think it is. You've got Hebrews chapter 2, I think I gave you a passage in Romans. And so hopefully you made a list at Mark 16, if you can just remember Mark 16, you go there, find the passages, two of which say this very thing. The purpose of a miracle is to confirm the word. So tonight we're going to look at the two of these combined, and to be the last of our studies on both the prophecies and the miracles. All of these, though, will be dealing specifically now with Jesus.
and even more specifically, with his crucifixion, and then that which would follow. So, if I might direct everybody's attention then to the Old Testament book of Zechariah. Not Zechariah from the New Testament, Elizabeth's husband, the priest, but Zechariah, the prophet from the Old Testament. And if you'll turn back there, next to the last book of the Old Testament, you will find, despite its being a rather large book, that it is a fairly obscure one. Very few people spend a lot of time in the book of Zechariah. This because it's what we commonly refer to as apocalyptic literature. It employs various kinds of symbols and figures, and parabolic drapery is another term I think that people will use, but it is couched in such terms that most people find it somewhat difficult to understand. I find it somewhat difficult in certain places, but tonight it'll form the foundation for our studies. We're going to look at several passages there, a couple of different chapters, and let's start then with Zechariah in chapter 13, the next to the last chapter in the book. In Zechariah chapter 13, in verse 7 it says, "Awake, O sword, against my shepherd, and against the man my associate, declares the Lord of hosts. Strike the shepherd, that the sheep may be scattered, and I will turn my hand against the little ones." Now, there's much else that he has to say, and more than one topic or event that he's going to be talking about there, but this is pretty straightforward. What do you think that prophecy is about? Who is the chief figure in the prophecy? Who's the shepherd? The shepherd is Jesus. Jesus is the shepherd. He referred to himself as a shepherd. Here we are told something about that shepherd in verse 7. We are told that he's going to be forsaken by his disciples. Now, if you're looking for a savior, if you are looking for a hero, excuse me.
And that's just a reflex there.
But if you're looking for somebody who's going to be a great leader of your country and of your nation, of your race, if you're looking to be rescued from the problems of oppressors and all of that, would you expect there to be much information about your heroic leader being abandoned and forsaken, people running away from him? No, you think exactly the opposite. They would flock to him, and they would die for him, and they will follow him, wherever he goes. It'll be nothing but, triumph. Verse 7 says nothing of the kind. He calls a sword against him. "And the man who is my companion," says the Lord of hosts, another term for the shepherd. "Strike the shepherd, and what will the sheep do?" They're going to be scattered. The fulfillment, of course, you'll find in more than one place, but we use Mark in chapter 14 and verse 50. Again, excuse me. There we go. So, you have very specifically there in Mark chapter 14 and 15 the description of how they all forsook him and fled. As a matter of fact, one of the men was so panic-stricken and left in such a haste that what did he leave behind? His very clothing was left behind. So you have a very specific prophecy, but lots of people panic and run away, and lots of nations have risen and fallen, and lots of leaders, have had problems like this. What's unique about this, brethren, is that this prophecy about this particular shepherd is couched among many other prophecies. It is in this is what I want, even the monks speaking this book about this shepherd and this great servant leader. And so it's not the only one, but I've arranged them here so that we'll be looking at them in kind of an ascending order. So, all right, gets my shepherd, he's going to be stricken and the sheep are going to be scattered. All right, fine. Now we come again to Zechariah, and this time much more specific and very much more difficult than to fulfill. Let's back up a couple of chapters to chapter 11. In Zechariah chapter 11, And starting in verse 12. And I said to them, if it is good in your sight, give me my wages. But if not, never mind. So they weighed out what? 30. Now, if you have shekels, and a little bit of a trick there, but if you have shekels, notice it is in italics. It just says 30 of silver. So 30 pieces of silver would be a better way to describe it. We're not told what value of coinage each one of these gold pieces represents. They put shekels in there, and that's fine. You know, they're just trying to give you an idea of, you know, that it is money. But 30 of silver as my wages. Now, the fulfillment of this one, of course, you'll find in Matthew chapter 26 and down verse 15. So, couple Zechariah 11, verse 12, to Matthew 26, in verse 15. Ideally, you would first write that on the pages of Zechariah, then right next to verse 12 in chapter 11, then you would write Matthew 26, verse 15. Then if you're keeping notes, you know, a separate sheet or whatever, you know, fine, but if you write those two together, that way, you know, reference that more quickly. And you'll probably notice, as we go through each of these, in your marginal references, you'll likely find these references already printed there for you. Frequently, I'll just draw a circle or something around it, you know, to highlight it in a given passage. But we're not done with Zechariah 11. So, sheep are going to be scattered, shepherd's going to be stricken down. Now, we know that this shepherd is going to be betrayed and sold for 30 pieces of silver. Look at the next verse in Zechariah 11. 13, the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, that magnificent price at which I was valued by them. So I took the 30 pieces of silver and threw them to the potter in the house of the Lord. Now, brethren, you might be able to prophesy that a leader could be forsaken and defeated and his people scattered. If you are also prophesying that this leader will be betrayed for a very specific sum of money, and that comes to pass also, that now is amazing. If you can then further prophesy what will happen to the 30 pieces of silver, and that it will not be treasured, it will not be precious, it will not be put in the bank, it will not be saved, and it will not be spent. But it's going to be cast away. And when it's cast away, where will it be cast away? Okay. Now, if I'd just been up to the task, brethren, I've walked down through the Valley of Gehenna myself. I did on the last day I was ever in Israel. It was one of the most amazing times of my entire life. I still just have such visions. I spent, I don't know, maybe an hour and a half in that little valley. In that valley, I didn't walk more than maybe a half a mile at the most. And in that half a mile, your mind just runs amok. As you're walking downhill, you look up on the left-hand side, and you see the walls of Jerusalem. On the right-hand side, it's really pretty dramatic, although they're not real high. You have perfect straight, you know, vertical cliffs of very beautiful rock, sometimes overhanging, and you can see there, you know, not just the beauty, but you can remember what was going to happen to Judas also. How would Judas, the betrayer who took the money, end his life? He's going to hang himself. And yet, some of them maintain some sort of contradiction, what also happened to him? Fell headlong and burst asunder. You ask yourself, well, is it a contradiction? How could the two happen? Okay, but when you walk down the valley, you can see that what would be very easy to do is to affix a rope to a branch, to trees that you can see that have overhanging the cliff. And if you were to throw yourself out there off of one of those branches, there'd be no way that you could get yourself back. You would, in fact, be hanging. And then, in fact, down long enough, depending on viewpoints and whatnot, you might be left hanging there until such time as either a branch might break of itself, the branch might be broken while somebody was trying to retrieve the body, the rope might be cut in order to retrieve the body, or in some other manner, it would eventually just fall and, you know, burst asunder down below. This is the valley. How do we know it's the valley? Well, we have, you know, various insights into where it was that he was to hang himself, but we also know where the money went. And guess what? Right next to those cliffs, we also have a what? A potter's field. So you can walk along in the valley, and then you can look up, you know, there, and you can see this area where, in antiquity, based on the excavation and various things, you know, they've been able to determine that they had the potter's field. Now, by this time, brethren, is this just a lot of really amazing coincidence? It is too precise. It is too specific. I have to tell you one more thing. It had nothing to do with prophecy, but the two events that took place while I was walking in that valley. Now, I'm walking down this valley, and suddenly I look up, and I see a man riding bareback on a horse, pell-mell, galloping up, you know, this valley and past me here. And it was just such a sight, you know, to see somebody riding horseback in this valley while I'm thinking about Jerusalem and all the events that have taken place. This is the Valley of Gehenna. There's just so many things that, you know, that have taken place here, both Old Testament and New. And here comes this guy riding, an Arab out of the area that is called Silwan. How many of you have heard of Silwan? Silwan is at the lower end of the Kidron Valley. This valley, Gehenna, and the Kidron work their way around the hills and merge. And at that lowest point right there, on the eastern side, is where the Mount of Olives first begins. And it is right there. That area is called Silwan. It's an Arab area there. So, I see this guy coming, you know, and I'm just marveling at this. I feel like I'm being transported back in time. I walked, you know, maybe another couple of few hundred yards or maybe a quarter of a mile, and I came to a police blockade. And at the police blockade, they took one look at me and they said, "You shouldn't go any further." Okay? Why?
Because you had to undergrow.
Because if I continue on down this valley into the area from whence this horseman came, now, I will have gone past the line where the Israeli police are maintaining the peace. And I will be going into Silwan, which is that Arab neighborhood, Palestinian neighborhood, that you hear so much about on the news, in which all the rock throwings, you know, and stuff takes place all the time. They have these clashes, you know, with the police down there. And then once again, I'm just transported back in time with the endless problems that have gone on in between those peoples and in that land, you know, throughout all of biblical history and beyond. My point here, brethren, is that this is all taking place, we're just looking at these individual prophecies so far, also in the place where we were told in other passages, which we've not studied in any of these lessons, that all these events would take place. So beyond even, you know, being told that they're going to take place, we were told where they were going to take place, and now you can go and visit those very locations yourself. Okay, now, that then is Zechariah chapter 11, verse 13, the 30 pieces, and the fulfillment there is in Matthew 27, verses 3 through 7. So while you're writing Matthew 27, verses 3 through 7, I'll just read. When Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that he was condemned, he changed his mind and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders, saying, "I have sinned and have betrayed innocent blood." But they said, "What is that to us? You see to it yourself." And after throwing the pieces of silver in the temple, he went out and hanged himself. But the chief priests took the pieces of silver and said, "It is not lawful to put them into the treasury, since it is the price of blood." And by the way, can you imagine the hardness of that heart that uttered those words? And so many of them agreeing with it. They have just verbally confessed to murder. This whole plot is a thing that they have, you know, concocted, now executed in the full conscious knowledge that it's really inexcusable. It's the price of blood. Then after taking counsel, they bought a potter's field with the silver for a burial ground for strangers. And it is because the finding of pottery and as well the very sanctified ground, you know, of cemetery, that throughout the ages we've come to be able to identify this location. Right now, continuing in Zechariah, turn now to chapter 12. So we started in 13, we went back to 11. Let's come down now in between the two and look at Zechariah chapter 12 and verse 10. I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication, so that they will look on me whom they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only son, and they will weep bitterly over him like the weeping over a firstborn. Now, if you're writing in the margins there, first location that you'd want to turn to for a fulfillment, I suppose, would be John chapter 19. John chapter 19, and in verses 16 through 19, and then again in verses 35 through 37. So Luke chapter 19, excuse me, John 19, 16 through 19, and then in 35 through 37. But as well, I'll give you two on this one because it is so very specific and so impossible, you know, to try to fake here. Luke chapter 23 and verses 26 through 31. In the very first passage I gave you, one of the soldiers had pierced his side with a spear, and immediately water and blood came out. And another scripture says, they'll look on him whom they have pierced. And so you have the actual quotation from Zechariah, you know, stated in the passage. Okay, and then Luke also, chapter 23, verses 26 through 31. Now, let's go ahead and leave Zechariah. Well, before we do it, I just can never stand it, you know, to leave Zechariah without looking at chapter 13 and the early verses. So kind of unrelated to what I'm working with Jesus and the crucifixion. Come to chapter 13, though, and look in verse 1. And that day, so it has to be the same day of chapter 12 we were just talking about, which deals with the crucifixion and that event where Jesus will be pierced and all the mourning will be taking place. In that day, a fountain will be opened for the house of David and for the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and for impurity. And it will come about in that day, declares the Lord of hosts, that I will cut off the names of the idols from the land. They will no longer be remembered, and I will also remove the prophets and the unclean spirit from the land. Now, in the first place, let's remember, he doesn't mean in that day within a 24-hour period. It means in that time frame, that place in history. What also happened in addition to Jesus being forsaken, his followers fleeing, he's betrayed, 30 pieces of silver, the silver winds up in a potter's field. We have all of these various events that are taking place. In the course of that time, we also have a fountain that's opened up for sin. And then we have the preaching of the apostles that goes on after that point. They are casting out demons. And they will cast out demons until what? What stopped the apostles and Christians in general from casting out demons?
When that which was perfect came.
Okay. Why are we not casting out demons today? That which is perfect has come. This miraculous power to cast out demons, no longer necessary since the word has already been confirmed. But again, I'm just being nasty. Brethren, what prevents you and me or any other Christians for the last roughly 2,000 years to cast out demons. What stopped us?
We don't do miracles anymore.
Okay, why?
The word is confirmed.
Yes, but why?
Christ was crucified.
Yeah, but why? Because there's no demons just right close to it. And the answer I'm looking for is because of verse 2 in Zechariah 13. What was going to happen in the same time frame that Jesus would be forsaken, betrayed, money would pass hands and wind up in the potter's field, there'd be sacrifice for sin, a fountain for sin and for impurity, and what was also one of the signs that the Messiah sacrifice for sin had come. Two things are going to cease. What are they?
Prophecy.
Word is confirmed, as Bob said a moment ago. And then? No more demon possession is going to be taking place. No more miracles to cast them out. Okay? So that's just a, you know, extra helping icing on the cake for you there in the midst of Zechariah, not dealing directly with the sacrifice of Jesus or prophecy of the sacrifice, that is the crucifixion, but, you know, seeing nonetheless all these prophecies of various and sundry things that are all being worked at starting in Zechariah chapter 12 and all the way through 13 and 14 to the end of that book.
Right.
You know, I think worldwide, but that is a good point, that it does specify the land there. Now you go to the definition of miracles and you look at how, what they were used for. I mean, not the definition, but the purpose of miracles. See, and he is not just the Savior of the Jews, but also of the Gentiles. And were they casting out demons of Gentiles too? Acts 16. Okay. So, you know, I view the teaching on demon possession to be equally applicable to Jew and to Gentile. Now, let's move back then out of the Zechariah 2, Psalm 22, which Jerry Bassett did such a fine job with last Sunday on two different occasions. Come to Psalm 22. His explication there was truly excellent. And so touched on these things that just last Sunday, coincidentally. But if you look now in Psalm chapter 22, would that I had the time, you know, just go through the whole thing. But let's start with verse 6. I am a worm and not a man, a reproach of men and despised by the people. All who see me sneer at me. They separate with the lip. They wag the head, saying, commit yourself to the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, because he delights in him. And hopefully you'll have a marginal reference. Maybe you've already written it in. But here we have a prophecy in Psalm 22:8 that people will be mocking. People will be rejecting him. That it's going to be passers-by. You're going to have a very public event that is taking place here. This, of course, is fulfilled in Matthew chapter 27, verses 43 and 44. He trusted in God. Let him deliver him now, if he'll have him. For he said, I am the Son of God. And the two robbers who were also crucified with him reproached him with what? The same words in Matthew 27. Do you suppose that the passers-by and the thieves that were on, you know, the hill with Jesus were consciously quoting Psalm 22? Were the passers-by disciples of Jesus when they spoke these things? No, they were mockers of the Lord. And unwittingly, themselves uttering the words that had been prophesied that they would utter. And even one of the thieves. Now, he's in a totally different boat, isn't he? Not just a Jew, you know, but here they are, you know, the story of the two, but here they are, guilty as they can be, and suffering, you know, a crucifixion. It just is absolutely astonishing to me that one of them, again, apparently unwittingly, would be quoting Psalm 22. Remember what I said about hostile witnesses being the best kind? Second to them is ignorant witnesses. The kind that don't even know what they're doing and wouldn't have a stake in trying to fulfill this thing, you know, at all. So, brethren, that is just truly amazing that they're able to actually, quote the words that were prophesied that they would speak. Now, continuing in chapter 22, and this whole thing, this Psalm of David, of course, is just magnificently messianic, but I'm trying to focus on the crucifixion right now. So let's skip on down and start with verse 14. I am poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd. My tongue cleaves to my jaws, and thou dost lay me in the dust of death. For dogs have surrounded me. A band of evildoers has encompassed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. Three different parts of Jesus' body were pierced in the crucifixion. One of them, we've talked about, is what? In his side. Also his hands and his feet. Did you know at the time that this was written, 1,000 years before it is fulfilled, that crucifixion hadn't even been invented yet? It would take the Romans many years later to even come up with the idea of extending such excruciating pain like this. And yet we have a description now of the manner in which this forsaken one whose disciples fled, who'd been betrayed for this amount of money, which wound up, you know, in the potter's field, is going to die. He will be pierced. And then different prophets tell us in the different portions of his body, all three locations, where he is going to be pierced through. That leads us, of course, in Psalm 22 now, to verse 18. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they what? They cast lots. Now, I give you verses for the thirst and all these different things that we talked about, but put John chapter 19 in verse 24 next to verse 18 here in Psalm 22, and you have the direct fulfillment. Brethren, how 1,000 years before it happens do you prophesy this many specific things, even any one of them, about a particular individual and then have it come to pass? It is a miracle. It is a confirmation of the word when the prophesied event comes to pass. Now, just quickly, I'm kind of running out of time here, but let's run down to Psalm 69 while you're in the Psalms. Come over to Psalm 69. And I am, as you've seen in the reading, skipping over other particulars about the crucifixion. But let's lay those aside. Come to Psalm 69 now, just hitting high points. And look at verse 21 in Psalm 69. They also gave me gall for my food, and for my thirst they gave me vinegar to drink. We just read about how thirsty he was. Just read about how emaciated he was going to be. Just read about the torture that the body was going to have to endure. How could you predict how people would mock him with gall and vinegar? How do you pull that off, brethren? The answer is you don't, unless God tells you that that's to be the case, which he does in Psalm 69 and is fulfilled then in Matthew chapter 27 and down in verse 34. Matthew 27 and verse 34. Okay, now back up a little bit in the Psalm and come to Psalm 34. This will be the last of our Psalms. Look at Psalm now 34 and down at verse 20. Now by this time, would you maybe have gotten the impression that this person's body, this shepherd, this forsaken and betrayed one, was going to be pretty badly abused? Yeah, you'd pretty well figured that out by now, haven't you? So now you come to Psalm 34, and down in verse 20, it says, he keeps all his bones, not one of them is broken. Tell me how you pull that one off. Okay? We're going to pierce the hands and the feet. which are notorious, brethren, for having a whole lot of what in them? Small bones that can be very easily broken. First time I tried inline skates, this thumb went down. Didn't take much at all. I actually put it in a cast that I made myself. I didn't need a doctor on this one. So I jerry-rigged, I think they used to call it, you know, this cast. And worked just fine. Old thumb works, you know, just great. But the bones in your hands and feet, brethren, are relatively fragile. They are numerous. And if you're going to go piercing hands and feet, what would you expect? Not one. Not one. That is truly impressive. I'm out of time, so I'm going to skip some here and direct your attention now to the New Testament. I was going to go to Isaiah 53 and add a couple of passages there, but let's just pass on that again. The lists of passages that Jesus fulfills in the crucifixion, you can find all over the internet. You can probably find it in your Bible in some notation there in the back or whatever. But let's go to John chapter 12 and take up a different topic now. In John chapter 12, we'll start the reading at verse 31. Jesus speaking, "Now judgment is upon this world. Now the ruler of this world shall be cast out. And I, if I be lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to myself." But he was saying this to indicate the kind of death by which he was to die. That's John 12. It's very shortly before the betrayal, the arrest, and all the events that are going to unfold here. But the length of time, you know, is of no matter. What did Jesus himself foretell? His own arrest, his own abuse, and the manner in which he would die. This expression, to be lifted up, is well known among those people at that time, now that the crucifixion has been invented as a form of torture and death. This is how it was referred to. It is to be lifted up after your hands and feet are pierced, you know, to hang there in such a manner that the agony is prolonged. Jesus foretold that that is the manner in which he would die. Now, I'd like to have you come back, though, and look in John, still, the Gospel of John, in the very early part of Jesus' preaching, in chapter 2. Look at John chapter 2, and we're going to read, starting there, right down, verses 13 through 22. John 2, 13 through 22. But it says there, "The Passover of the Jews was at hand. Jesus went up to Jerusalem. He makes the scourge. He drives them out of the temple. 17, zeal for your house will consume me. 18, the Jews therefore answered and said to him, what sign do you show to us, seeing that you do these things? Now, brethren, in our vernacular, they said, who do you think you are? What gives you the right to do such a thing as this?" And the answer is in verse 19. "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." Jesus foretold how he would die. He also foretold what here? Resurrection. That he would not stay dead. How do you foretell that? How do you pull that off, brethren? Coupled with John 12 and John 2, the verses I've just given you, let's take a look at a third passage. We'll have to leave John now and go to the Gospel of Matthew and chapter 12. This is the third in that series, only these three, John 12, John 2, and now Matthew 12, verses 38, 39, and 40. Matthew 12, 38. "Some of the scribes and Pharisees answered him, saying, Teacher, we want to see a sign from you. But he answered and said to them, An evil and adulterous generation craves for a sign, and yet no sign shall be given to it, but the sign of Jonah the prophet. For just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the sea monster, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. Now please take note, John 2 would be where on the timeline of Jesus' ministry?
Just relatively, John 2 is at the very beginning.
Would Matthew 12 be close to that? No, we're well into Jesus' preaching now. He began his ministry in a violent act of purification, removing sin from the temple, the house of God. And when he did that, they asked for a sign. He said, I'm going to give you a sign. And what was it? 3 days after you destroy this temple, he was speaking of his body, and I will what? We'll raise it up again. Matthew 12 is a totally different occasion, brethren, when again he specifies 3 days, and I'm back. Okay, now, that being the case, move from Matthew to chapter 27. Is that beginning, middle, or end? Well, we got 28 chapters. In Matthew chapter 27 now, let's start the reading at verse 38. We'll read down to 43. 27, 38 to 43. That time, two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and one on the left. And those passing by were hurling abuse at him, wagging their heads and saying, you who are going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. In the same way, the chief priests also, along with the scribes and the elders, were mocking him and saying, he saved others. He cannot save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him now come down from the cross, and we shall believe in him. He trusts in God. Now a quote from Psalm 22:8 that we read earlier. He takes pleasure in him, for he said, or he trusted God, let him deliver him now if he takes pleasure in him, for he said, I am the Son of God. What did they remember about the teaching of Jesus? That resurrection passage, brethren, those resurrection foretellings, those resurrection promises, they really stuck in the craw. Those resurrection promises, those prophecies, worse, I deem, than the miracles he was working and the other things that he taught and the criticisms that he offered to these men. Statements like that really bothered them. They knew what he was talking about. They got it. And this is the challenge. Okay? We're putting you to death now. Let's see you stop the death. Let's see if you can fulfill the resurrection. We're putting it to the test in the most hard-hearted manner that you can imagine. Now that leads us, brethren, in Matthew chapter 27, down to verse 62 through 66. On the next day, which is the one after the preparation, the chief priests, the Pharisees, gathered together with Pilate, and they said, Sir, we remember that when he was still alive, that deceiver said, after 3 days I am to rise again. Therefore, give orders for the grave to be made secure until the third day, lest the disciples come and steal him away, and say to the people, he's risen from the dead. And the last deception will be worse than the first. Pilate said to them, you have a guard. Go. Make it as secure as you know how. They went out, made the grave secure, and along with the guard, they set a seal on the stone. Now, Jesus himself is foretelling the manner in which he will die, which very precisely fulfills quite a few different Old Testament passages about that crucifixion. He also declares that that grave cannot hold him, and how long it'll be before he comes back out of that tomb. How long is it? 3 days. Did he catch anybody's attention? He caught everybody's attention. He caught the disciples' attention. He caught the neutral people's attention. He caught his enemies' attention. He caught everybody's attention you possibly could with that. They were still thinking about it the day after they killed him. So that first things first, let's make it as secure as we can to prevent anybody attempting to fulfill this prophecy that he made. All right? Let's now do a quick string, brethren, in Mark chapter 8. Now, if you're linking these together now, I gave you three, John 12, John 2, and Matthew 12. I gave you three separate, Matthew 27, and we had those passages. And now we're going to go to Mark 8, start a new string. Just want to put a couple of things together here now. And it's really on the same topic as we just were considering. But this time, I just want you to see what Mark does. Okay? So in Mark chapter 8, look at verses 27 through 31. Okay, so new topic, same topic, the subtitle. And go Mark 8, 27 through 31. Jesus went out along with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he questioned his disciples, saying to them, "Who do people say that I am?" Is this the beginning of his ministry? Is this the end of his ministry? Mark 9, no, it's the middle. Have we already seen him declare he would only be 3 days in the grave in the middle of his ministry in Matthew 27? Or excuse me, Matthew 12? Yeah, we did. Is this that event? No, it's not. It's the fourth time that Jesus declares this. In Mark chapter 9, verse 28, they told him, some John the Baptist, others Elijah, or one of the prophets. He continued questioning them, "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered and said to him, "You are the Christ." And he warned him, "Tell no one about him." And, so it's tied directly to their recognition of who he is now. He began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things, like be rejected, be betrayed, sold out, pierced, and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes, and be killed, and what? After 3 days, rise again. Please note the word at the very beginning of 31, he what to teach them? He began to teach them. He was teaching and teaching and teaching and teaching about these 3 days. Everybody knew about these 3 days. Everybody knew. He had said these things. That's Mark 8. Look at Mark 9. Mark 9, verses 30 through 32. From there they went out, began to go through Galilee, and he was unwilling for anyone to know it. For he was teaching his disciples and telling them, the Son of Man is to be delivered into the hands of men. They'll kill him. And when he's been killed, he'll rise 3 days later. Now, everybody knew he was saying this, but look at 32. They didn't understand the statement, and they're afraid to ask. Okay? So, he's pounding this information into their heads. And they're wrestling with it, which is the best way to get anybody to really learn and focus, you know, upon anything. Look at chapter 10 in the Gospel of Mark, 32 through 34. Mark 10, 32 through 34, they're on the road, going up to Jerusalem. Jesus walking on ahead of them. They're amazed. Those who follow are fearful. Again, he took the 12 aside. Again, he tell them what was going to happen to him. Behold, we're going up to Jerusalem. The Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and the scribes. They'll condemn him to death and will deliver him to the Gentiles. They'll mock him and spit on him and scourge him and kill him. That's now nine specifics about the crucifixion. And then, 3 days later, what? Number 10. Jesus was relentless in his teaching. Oh, well then there's Mark chapter 14. In Mark chapter 14, look at verses 57 and 58. Some stood up and began to give false testimony against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I'll destroy this temple made with hands, and in 3 days I'll build another one made without hands. Okay? Now, laying aside whether or not they understood what he was doing, which we just recognized, even the disciples could struggle with it, did everybody get that he had said something about destruction and rebuilding in 3 days? Okay. Then there's the next chapter, Mark chapter 15. In Mark 15, it's verses 29 through 32. Those passing by were hurling abuse at him, wagging their heads and saying, "Ha, you are going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. Save yourself and come down from the cross." The same way the chief priests also, along with the scribes, mocking him among themselves and saying, "He saved others. He cannot save himself. Let this Christ, the King of Israel, now come down from the cross so that we may see and believe." And those who were crucified with him were casting the same insult at him. Now, brethren, Mark is again and again and again saying, Jesus taught again and again and again, once they kill him, how long before he's back? 3 days. Now we come to the end and we're seeing how they're killing him. Just to say, thoroughly and completely, no mistake about his dying, no passing out and accidentally being buried, no, you know, super physician coming who could raise him up somehow, no body stolen. We have the grave as secure as possible. Brethren, with thousands of witnesses to the prophecy and hundreds of witnesses to the fulfillment, did Jesus stay in the grave? How long was he there? And then, a fountain, brethren, for sin and for purity in those days. The end of all prophecy. The end of casting out demons. The end of miracles. Because, brethren, and I direct your attention now to Romans chapter 1, I would suggest to you that after 3 days, the greatest possible miracle of all had been worked. It was a combination of the miracle of prophecy and power over death itself. Romans chapter 1 begins like this. Paul, a bondservant of Christ Jesus, called an apostle, set apart for the gospel of God, which he promised beforehand through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures, concerning his Son, who was born of a descendant of David according to the flesh. Beforehand, through the prophets, we would call this miraculous prophecy. We get the prophecy, what line he's going to come from, descendant of David. Is in verse 4, it now says, declared the Son of God with what? What was one of the words for miracle? Dynamite. He was declared with dynamite, explosively declared by the resurrection from the dead to be what? The Son of God. Who is Jesus of Nazareth? The Son of God. Who was Jesus, an obscure rabbi? A good man. A wise man. He was able to do things we can't explain. He was a marvel, that guy. We wondered at him. It was amazing to see the things that happened when he was around. Okay? So, you were so blessed as to be one of the apostles, and you saw him walk on water, still a storm, heal the sick, magnify loaves and fishes, wither a fig tree. You saw, you know, all of this, brethren, amazing stuff. But if you then saw him crucified and you fled, and one of your own had betrayed him, just like the psalmist said he would, and for the amount he said, And that's where the money went. And then after saying again and again and again and again himself, 3 days, and I'll be back from the dead. Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And you know it by the power of a resurrection that was testified witness to by hundreds, brethren. It is as sure as the fact that I am now 23 seconds over time. Class dismissed.